Welcome to episode 1457 of the 1010 Thrive podcast, brought to you by 1010 Thrive Ministries. 1010 Thrive, 10 minutes a day based on 10 guidelines for abundant living. In our previous episode, James invited us into the hidden years of Nazareth, where Jesus was known not as a rabbi or miracle worker, but simply as an older brother. Woven into that ordinary life was something extraordinary. Jesus's quiet excellence, steadfast truthfulness, and patient love set him apart in ways James could sense but not fully understand. The episode culminated in the temple, when 12-year-old Jesus declared, "Did you not know that I must be in my Father's house?" Though Jesus returned home in obedience, James realized there was a part of his brother's life that lay beyond his reach. It was a question that would linger for years. Acts of the Apostles, Part 2, Chapter 2.
He left. That is the simple version. The longer version is that he went to be baptized by John in the Jordan, and then he did not come back. Not to the workshop, not to Nazareth, not to the life he had lived with us for 30 years. Father was gone. There was work to be done. But that was left to me and our other brothers. I do not think any of us understood at first what had changed. You grow up alongside someone. You share a table and a trade and 10,000 ordinary days. And then one morning he is simply not there, and the workshop is quieter than it should be, and you keep reaching for the tool you always handed him before you remember he is gone. Gone to do what exactly was the question none of us could answer. The stories came back to Nazareth in pieces. He had been baptized. There was an approving voice from heaven, some said. But people say many things, and voices from heaven are exactly the kind of detail that grows in the telling. He had gathered followers, fishermen mostly, from the lake, what many of you call the Sea of Galilee, men who had left their boats and their families and their livelihoods to follow a carpenter from our village. He was teaching in the synagogues. He was healing people and doing all manner of miracles. I was actually a witness to that very first miracle, but I did not recognize it for what it was. We were at a wedding in Cana. It was a cousin's celebration. The whole family was there. It was the kind of occasion that pulled you from the workshop for 3 days, whether you could spare the time or not. My mother was asked to help manage the event, and Jesus was there, with many of his new followers who were still finding their footing around him. At some point, the wine ran out. This was not a small embarrassment. In our culture, to run out of wine at a wedding feast was to shame the family hosting it. My mother noticed before anyone else and went to Jesus. I was close enough to hear what she said.
They have no wine.
Mother, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come.
Servants, do whatever he tells you.
I have thought many times about that exchange. She did not argue with him. She did not press. She simply told the servants to do whatever he said, and then she waited, as if she knew something about him that the rest of us did not, or had not yet admitted we did. He told the servants to fill 6 stone jars with water. They filled them to the brim. Then he told them to draw some out and take it to the master of the feast. The master tasted it and called the bridegroom over and said, "Everyone serves the good wine first, and when people have drunk freely, then the poor wine. But you have kept the good wine until now. I was standing there. I saw the jars. I knew what had gone into them, and I went home to the workshop." That is the part that is hardest to explain. I had just watched my brother turn water into wine at a family wedding, and I went home, and I opened the workshop and I picked up my tools, not because I disbelieved what I had seen. I had been standing there. But there is a kind of belief that does not yet know what to do with itself, a belief that has not found the courage of its own conviction. I believed something had happened. I did not know how to let that something reorganize my life, so I set it aside. The way you set aside a piece of wood, you are not ready to work yet. The synagogue in Nazareth invited him back to teach. He came, read from Isaiah, said the scripture was fulfilled in their hearing. The congregation initially marveled, and then something shifted. The marveling curdled into offense. Who does he think he is? Is this not the carpenter's son? Do we not know his mother, his brothers? They nearly threw him off a cliff. Nearly threw my brother off a cliff. In the town where we grew up, He walked away from it untouched. The crowd parted for him like water, they said, and he simply walked through them and left. I was in that synagogue. I heard him read, and I did not follow him when he walked out. People ask me why. Why? When Peter and Andrew dropped their nets at a word, when Matthew left a tax table, when fishermen and zealots and people with nothing to lose walked away from everything, why did his own brother stand in the back of a synagogue and watch him leave and go home to the workshop? That's the same thing I did after the wedding at Cana. I have thought about this for many years. I think there are several answers, and none of them are entirely flattering to me. The first is the ordinary skepticism of familiarity. I knew him, or thought I did. The men who followed him were responding to someone they had just encountered. The strangeness of him, the authority, the words that landed differently from anything they had heard before. I had been hearing him talk since I could remember. I had seen him stub his toe. I had watched him take his time measuring a piece of wood. Familiarity is a very efficient cure for wonder. The second answer is harder to say. The claims being made about him, or that he seemed to be making about himself, were enormous. Not just prophet, not just teacher. The things he was saying and doing pointed somewhere much larger than that, and the larger they pointed, the more dangerous it seemed to believe them. If you believe a man is a good teacher and you are wrong, you have lost nothing but time. If you believe a man is the Son of God and you are wrong or right, your life is no longer your own. I was not ready for that. And the third answer, the one I am least proud of, is that I was protecting something. Not him, myself, the workshop, the reasonable life I had built, the quiet competence of a man who knows his trade and does it well and does not require the world to rearrange itself around his expectations. Jesus had always made the reasonable life feel insufficient, even as a child, even when he was simply being himself, being steady and truthful and patient in ways the rest of us were not. He had always, without trying, made you aware of the distance between what you were and what you might be. And when he left, and the stories came back, and that distance became impossible to ignore, I chose to stay where I was, in the workshop, where the measurements were clear and the wood behaved according to its grain, and nothing required me to reconsider everything I thought I knew. There came a point when the family decided to act. The reports had become worrying. Not just the miracles, we had developed a complicated relationship with the miracle stories by then, but the crowds, the opposition from the Pharisees, the way things were escalating. And there were those who were saying quietly that he was out of his mind, that the pressure had become too much, that someone needed to go and bring him home before he got himself killed. We went. Our mother, my brothers, and me. We tracked him to a house in Capernaum, and the house was so full of people that we could not get inside. We sent word in through the crowd, a voice passing the message inward through the crowd.
Your mother and brothers are outside looking for you.
What came back was not what I expected. He looked at the people sitting around him, and he said, I was told this by someone who was inside, who heard it directly.
Who are my mother and my brothers? Here are my mother and my brothers. Whoever does the will of God is my brother and sister and mother.
We stood outside in the street, and the message filtered back to us, and we absorbed it in silence. I want to be careful about how I tell this. He was not repudiating us. I understand that now. He was not saying that Mary was not his mother, or that we were nothing to him. He was saying something about a larger belonging, a family defined not by blood, but by shared allegiance. He had been saying versions of this his whole ministry. But we were standing outside, and everyone he had just called his family was sitting inside. And whatever he meant theologically, what it felt like was this. The door into that larger space I had sensed since the temple at 12, the space I had no key to, had just been described, and I was still on the wrong side of it. We went home, again, without him. I did not follow him then. I still was not ready. I'm not sure I could have said what I was waiting for. But something in me was shifting, something the workshop and the reasonable life were no longer quite able to hold in place.
Many of us recognize ourselves in James. We may not openly reject Jesus, but we often hesitate at the threshold where faith asks for more than admiration. It asks for surrender. Like James, we may prefer the predictability of the workshop, the places where we understand the rules, control the outcomes, and preserve the lives we have carefully constructed. Yet Christ continues to call us beyond what is merely reasonable into what is eternally true. To be continued.